get around the corner here.
It's like waiting for everyone to get for the pledge.
That's right. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here this bright Monday morning with the sun and the snow. We have three bills for public hearing and possible work sessions. We're going to work from the top down, so I'll open up the first public hearing on Senate Bill 83A.
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 83A came to you on referral from the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. It deals with the Public Utilities Commission and court review of agency actions. Now, as you may know, under Oregon law, persons adversely affected by agency orders are entitled to have the courts review the final orders in that proceeding. Judicial review is usually done by the Oregon Court of Appeals. The Public Utilities Commission does do administrative hearings, and there are contested cases, but current law allows any party to a hearing to have standing to seek judicial review, including for those cases that may not qualify as contested cases. So Senate Bill 83 clarifies that a party to a contested case may seek judicial review and may only be sought in contested cases.
All right. It does. Thank you. Michael? So Michael Grant's scheduled to give testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony this morning on Senate Bill 83A? When you're ready.
Good morning, Chair Prezonsky.
Good morning.
Of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Grant. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Public Utility Commission. And I'm here to specifically kind of confirm what Chan has already summarized to you. Senate Bill 83 is simply intended to fix an inconsistency in statute related to the judicial review of commission orders. The appeal of commission orders has had a unique history. For many years, the commission's contested case orders were treated differently than those from other agencies. Instead of being reviewed by the Court of Appeals, commission orders first went on appeal to the Marion County Circuit Court. With the support of Marion County Circuit Court back in 2005, we succeeded in getting legislation passed to make the judicial review of our orders consistent with that of other agencies under the Administrative Procedures Act. Although the intent of the 2005 legislation was limited to the review of contested case orders, that is, those orders that are issued after a formal trial-like process with an evidentiary hearing, we recently discovered that language in the 2005 bill inadvertently made all orders of the Commission contested case orders for purposes of appeal. This includes orders that are issued after an informal public meeting process. Having the Court of Appeals review these informal orders is a problem because there is no evidentiary record or an order that contains findings of facts and conclusions of law for the Court of Appeals to consider. Senate Bill 83 is intended to fix that problem and fulfill the original intent of the 2005 legislation to make the judicial review of our orders the same with orders from other agencies. Thus, contested case orders would be reviewed by the Court of Appeals, and informal orders, referred to as orders other than contested cases under the APA, will be reviewed by the Marion County Circuit Court. There is no known opposition to the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Manning first.
Thank you, Chair. Just one question. I noticed that several times you mentioned Marion County. Is this unique to Marion County only?
Chair Prezonsky, Senator Manning, the judicial review of state agency orders usually goes through the Marion County Circuit Court, given its location here in Salem. But the judicial review of our orders is not limited to Marion County.
So all of the counties involved in this process, it will come up through the court here. So it's a statewide and not just a particular
right
jurisdiction.
Yeah. Chair Prezonsky, Senator Manning, the appeals of the Marion County Circuit Court would only be involved in appeals involving our informal orders. And those orders, again, we regulate public utilities, so those orders are generally in statewide applicability. If there was some decision that kind of affected a certain county, particularly, and they wanted to seek redress, or folks in that county wanted to seek redress, under the Administrative Procedures Act, all appeals of these orders in other than contested cases would be held in Marion County Circuit Court.
Thank you.
All right, so Michael, Senator Thatcher.
Just a real quick question, because I wasn't sure. Maybe you could clarify for me and others who might be wondering what exactly the orders are. What does that consist of, just briefly?
Sure. Chairperson Gansky, Senator Thatcher. Contested case orders are orders which follow the trial-like process. So these would be like, they run the range of a simple consumer complaint case against a utility for improper billing, all the way up to a large utility rate case in which they want, like Portland General Electric, for example, wants to change rates. So those orders, we would have a trial-like process, and if they were appealed, they would go to the Court of Appeals. The informal type orders are like property finance applications that utilities may file. We usually kind of provide notice and opportunity for comment on those and handle those through regular public meetings. And those orders, if those were challenged, those would go to Marion County Circuit Court.
Okay. Senator Lithicum.
For clarification, with regard to this broad range of orders, does that include orders from other agencies like Oregon Water Resources Department and those sorts of things?
Hey, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Lithicum. No, this is simply Public Utility Commission orders addressing matters related to utility rates and service.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So, Michael, just for, I guess, for clarification, my understanding is that what we're trying to do here is make the formal orders of the PUC follow and track just like any other agency that has an administrative law judge, makes a decision. Those go through the Court of Appeals, and for whatever reason, through the drafting or whatever, both formal and informal have been going through the Marion Court. And then I assume from Marion Circuit Court, then they can go into the Court of Appeals based on just the judicial review.
Correct. Almost, Chair Brzezinski. Traditionally, all of our...
In horseshoes, it's good. Grenades, you're okay. But here, maybe not.
Traditionally, both our formal and informal orders used to go through Marion County Circuit Court. The idea was to have our formal orders go to the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in the 2005 legislation, language is inserted to make both informal and formal go to the Court of Appeals. So now we're just trying to move the formal back to the Marion County Circuit Court.
All right. But my clarification is that when it's under the current system, mm-hmm. if someone went to Marion County Circuit Court on a formal order, mm-hmm. once that was decided at that court, they still would have additional judicial review from that circuit court, or are they I'm just trying to figure out if this is unique, that they would have final appellate review or not. And I understand we're going to change this where it's not going to be a problem. I'm just trying to historically get an understanding.
Oh, yeah. Historically, you're correct. If an order went to the Marion County Circuit Court, the Marion County Circuit Court would issue a decision, and that could be challenged at the Court of Appeals.
All right.
Well, you got that right.
Just want to make sure. It's Monday morning. Never know.
Senator Thatcher. Thank you. So this has been in place for 12 years, and it's not been brought up before.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, yes, this has been on the books for about 12 years. We have very few orders other than contested cases that do get appealed, and that's why we never had this issue. However, last year we had a decision at a public meeting in which there was a concern that that might be challenged, and that kind of got us looking more carefully at the language and realized that there was this error here.
Senator Lithicum?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, Michael, thank you very much. Let me see if anyone else wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 83A.
Thank you.
Not seeing any. Thank you. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing. I think we got all our paperwork. So I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 83A. Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 83A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 83A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Any volunteers?
I love explaining PUC stuff. Just kidding. I would all carry it, though.
There's a go-getter for a Monday morning. So Senator Thatcher will be our carrier on 83A. We'll close the work session on 83A, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is Senate Bill 96A. Chana?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, here is another bill that's been referred to us by the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. It deals with the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, which licenses and regulates insurance businesses and professionals in the state, including investment advisors. Investment advisors are currently required to carry $10,000 in bonds to protect clients against losses as a result of regulatory violations, but they are not required to carry what's called errors or omissions insurance, which is a liability insurance. Senate Bill 96 does make that requirement of an amount of at least $1 million.
All right, thank you. I have Rick Blackwell, and I believe it's Aaron. Is it Theobald? Please correct me when you get up here, because I know I just butchered it.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, speaking for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager of the Division of Financial Regulation within DCBS. With me is Aaron Theobald, so pretty close. Senior Policy Analyst with the division. And we're just here to briefly talk about Senate Bill 96A, which came to you from the Senate Business and Transportation Committee on a unanimous due pass recommendation.
The pressure's on.
So Senate Bill 96A is part of a broader strategy that the department is pursuing to both protect investors through enhanced examinations on the front end, and we're working through the ways and means process on that. Then also making sure that on the back end, if something does go wrong, that investors are more adequately protected and may receive some measure of recovery if things go wrong. So for background, as Chana mentioned, we regulate investment advisors and broker-dealers. These are the folks that help you trade stocks and other securities or give you investment advice. The firms can actually have custodial access, which they actually have control of the funds, or they have discretionary access, in which they actually can make trades without directly contacting the client on each particular trade or investment decision. So once we license the folks that make these decisions or trade for you, they're examined every 3 years in the case of investment advisors. We receive balance sheets, we look over financials, but we try to make sure that the investment advisors are solvent and not in danger of going bankrupt. Nonetheless, sometimes things do go wrong, unfortunately. We've had at least two cases in the last year where maybe $6 million of investment money has been lost due to acts by the licensed or should have been licensed investment advisor. As mentioned, currently folks carry a $10,000 bond. Raising a bond is prohibitively expensive. Errors and omission insurance is usually a better, more cost-effective way to ensure that there's a financial backstop. And with proper and factual pleading, lawyers, their investment protection attorneys that are working on behalf of investors can usually find ways to make sure that the investors can access that errors and omissions policy. So that's really the sense of the bill. The A engrossed version does actually make one change that instead of having folks with discretionary or custodial access, having the insurance, it would require everyone to have it. In discussions with stakeholders, it seemed there was really no functional difference between someone giving advice and having the client work for them, essentially, and then those that actually have decision-making authority. So with that, I'm glad to take any questions you might have on the bill.
All right, thank you. Senator Denver, or let's see, Aaron, are you here as a lifeline support? Excellent. Senator Denver?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The bill has a couple of exemptions, and I'm wondering if you could explain them. One, an exemption for someone who's an advisor who's based outside the state, largely, and I'm just wondering what happens if, in the case of bad advice being given to someone who then needs to make a claim.
Well, Chair Przanski and Senator Dembro, in that case, we'd probably try to work with the state securities regulator in the state where that person is licensed. Most states do require some kind of surety bond already. Most are in about $35,000 range from the research that I did prior to this work. But if the person was required to be licensed here, then we would go after them as well.
Mm-hmm. But why not make this identical requirement of them if they're licensed in the state?
Chair Przanski and Senator Dembro, we're not entirely sure that we could require insurance from someone that's licensed through another state just because of Commerce Clause issues. So.
And if I could follow up. And then there's also an exemption for somebody subject to Section 15 of the Securities Act of 1935 or 34. They're not required to comply. So who are they?
So Senator Przanski and Senator Dembro, I would have to go back to the office and make sure what those broker-dealers are, but my sense is that we would be preempted from regulating broker-dealers that are that would be licensed under the Securities and Exchange Commission.
See if Erin has any comment for that.
Sure, please.
Senator Brzezinski, for the record, my name is Erin Tiberba. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Division of Financial Regulation. Yes, Senator Dembro, we are preempted by federal law from regulating those entities.
Senator Manning, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You think $1 million is sufficient?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Manning, we do think that $1 million is certainly a big step above $10,000, and it's a fairly attainable insurance policy, which is frankly a best practice that many firms already are getting for themselves.
Okay, well, I asked the question because you had mentioned $6 million in loss previously, so I don't know if that was one instance or, you know, multiple instances that combined to make the $6 million.
Right. Chair Brzezinski and Senator Manning, those were multiple instances. It was actually two firms. So one firm, an example that I had raised, one firm would be covered by the policy. The other firm wouldn't cover everything, but between the bond, the insurance, and maybe whatever other assets that the firm has, be satisfying the judgment there. So.
And what about the follow-up? So, I'm very aware about investors because they're all out over the place and they're, you know, trying to get folks money and stuff. Are you finding that the reason for this is that there is an uptick in abuse or fraud in these areas?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Manning, we do believe that the instances of senior financial abuse are underreported. In fact, there's a bill that we have in front of Senate Human Services, Senate Bill 95, which requires reporting of instances of suspected financial abuse from these same professionals, the ones that are.
And does this bill have teeth in it?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Manning, this bill falls within the securities law, which has a number of civil penalties, cease and desist orders, restitution, private rights of action, et cetera. Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Thatcher, then Senator Lithicum.
Thank you. And I was trying to pull up something on my computer, but it's still thinking, so it's not helping me. But maybe you could explain a little bit. You talked, I think, briefly about what other states do, and you mentioned something about $35,000 that
yes.
they have in errors and omissions in other states? What is it that I was trying to understand what you were trying
to
say?
Of course. Thank you. Chair Brzezinski and Vice Chair Thatcher, many states require a surety bond of $35,000 carried by. That seems to be the typical number in most states. While we do have authority to raise the bond in statute to up to $100,000, our research found that raising a bond even to $35,000 would be quite a bit more costly than the insurance policy.
And then maybe you could explain, do other states also, or are there other states that do what you're proposing?
Chair Brzezinski and Vice Chair Thatcher, no, we would be the first, frankly, but there is, the national conversation, there is a interest in trying to figure out what to do with unpaid awards. There's a study that PIABA, the public interest bar, put forward, said that one in three awards nationally are unpaid. So when these sorts of claims go to arbitration, to the in front of the licensing authority that covers all broker-dealers, investment advisors nationally, it's called FINRA. FINRA arbitration awards typically only like two out of three are actually getting satisfied. So this is actually a national problem. Hopefully this will prompt other states to act as well.
Senator Lithicum.
Some follow-up on Senator Thatcher's questions with regard to the surety bond for $35,000 versus the $1 million, and I realize rates will be different depending upon the quality and asset value of the corporate structure. But what do those numbers look like?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Lithicum, we think the premium would be around $2,000 a year for a policy of $1 million, and again. Like you say, it really does matter on the assets that the person manages, and then just the risk. So if the person has basically stayed clean and out of trouble, presumably the their insurance risk would be lower. So,
all right. Any other questions? All right. Let's see. I think that's it. So why don't you just stay there for a second. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on Senate Bill 96A? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 96A. And Aaron, I'm going to excuse you from the dais. And if we're ready, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 96A. And Senator Thatcher?
Okay. I would move, as the chair requests, Senate Bill 96A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 96A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher. I still have some questions that I need to get answered before I vote yes.
Okay, and are there stuff that you want to put on the record? Do you want to talk to Rick afterwards, or however you want to do it?
Well, I guess I would have some questions on if somebody isn't handling $1 million a year, why they would need to have a $1 million policy. I don't know. Maybe that's just not even an issue. I don't know. Okay. That's one of my questions.
I too have some questions that just bear a little bit more thought with regard to how the insurance will $2,000 right up front doesn't sound like a large sum, and yet at the same time we know it is. Everyone's got to find that in their management fees somewhere. That'll raise cost to consumers and whatnot. This is errors and omissions insurance, which you know as well as I know. Everybody hates paying insurance. If you're a clean guy, you'll never use it, but you'll pay for it regardless year after year after year. And so the difference, I don't actually know the value of the or difference to my corporate entity, what the surety bond would look like and what $1 million of errors and omissions interest would look like.
Okay. And Rick, if you have some feedback, because I was going to ask you regarding the security bond, I understand that that's been looked at and what the potential. Can you just give us some stuff on the record and see where we go from there?
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski. If I can answer the senator's questions in turn. Senator or Vice Chair Thatcher, we did look at kind of average, I think, assets under management, and it's about $20 million is what most firms will manage on average. And the the insurance may not necessarily be for, all $20 million. It could be an individualized instance. And then I suppose to pivot to Senator Linthicum's question about usage, E&O insurance can also be provide legal defense coverage. So the person that, it was maybe wrongly accused of some sort of breach of duty or something could, I believe, access that insurance as well to help cover them and so stay out of trouble.
All right. Any other discussions, Senator Manning?
Chair, just this question. He had mentioned that right now I believe that they're at $10,000, and to increase it to $35,000, I think that he said there was some that it would be more costly to do it like that versus insurance. So if that's true, I think that would help me better much, explain.
Yeah. Yeah, and Rick, let me just ask you, my understanding, this was the bill basically came out of a work group in the sense of working with people that have vested interest in the institution and this process, and this was kind of what was decided.
Chair Przanski, that's correct. We actually, in the interim, pulled together a group of interested parties that would either be purchasing this insurance or may actually be attempting to access the insurance, and this was the result of that.
Yeah, and so basically it sounds like, well, I'm going to call the certified smart people, that at least those who are involved felt that going or having the option of going with a insurance policy versus sticking to the traditional surety bond process would give the coverage protection and also seem to be maybe financially more easy for the business to assimilate into its business.
Yeah, I couldn't put it better myself. Yes.
All right. Senator Lethicon.
Can you give us some feedback? I'm sure you reviewed other states and their disfavor with insurance and their favor for surety bonds. All 49 other states went one way, and Oregon's choosing what appears to be an alternative path. It sounds fine, but those states had some reason for taking the path they took.
Chair Przanski.
I guess I'm just going to say it seems to me that we are on that same path with the other 49 states. And now we've got, let's say, a group of people in the way of the work group that said, you know, how about this as an alternative as compared to doing what we have traditionally done? Rick?
Chair Przanski and Senator Linthicum, I wouldn't be able to speculate on how other states have presented this. We, I think, maybe because of our crossover between insurance and securities regulation, had considered a number of alternatives to try to stem this issue of, what do we do on the back end when things have fallen apart, right? Many states have chosen a bond because maybe they adopted the Uniform Securities Law and a set of laws that require surety bonds for this kind of activity. Rhode Island's bond is actually quite a bit higher and even filters down to the individual level. Most states, though, are basically capped at 35, and it looks very similar to what we have here in Oregon. So.
All right, Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just, I'm reminded that this bill came to us after going through the other committee, the business committee. Rick, did anybody come out in opposition at that time?
Chair Przanski and Senator Dimbrough, I don't recall if there was stated opposition on the record. I could go back and take a look. We did obviously have some questions about how the errors and omissions insurance policy would work in terms of how would you access it in terms of intentional fraud, which we recognize would not be usually written into these policies. But again, we think with appropriate pleading that isn't necessarily an issue. So.
All right, Senator Thatcher.
Yeah, thank you. I just had a question. Still going back to that.
Of course.
You talked about $20 million dollars worth of assets being managed. That doesn't mean unnecessarily that there's 20 customers and $1 million or whatever. I mean, it could be an average of still $500,000 that's being managed. So I'm wondering, does errors and omission the insurance that you're talking about, is that aggregate or is that per occurrence, or how would that work?
Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, my sense is at least the bill I think requires it's just the policy is $1 million. I think it would be in the aggregate. So
we have a lifeline in the back of the room if we want to bring her back.
Yes, actually, Aaron, if you'd like to come back, please.
Sorry.
Well, I didn't know we're gonna have that many questions. I would have asked Aaron to stay. I just didn't want her.
Chair Przanski, again, Aaron Tieberbaugh from the Division of Financial Regulation. Typically, this type of insurance would be $1 million per occurrence, and then that would be an aggregate of about $5 million.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Don't leave yet. All right. So we have a motion.
Oh, please. We're good. No, we're good.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Are we good? Or I'm getting ready to move the motion unless we got more comment that needs to be
done. I think we can proceed.
Senator Lethicon.
I think the comment that you made a second ago is, excuse me, relevant and an important issue. If this is an errors and omissions policy, it's errors and omissions. It doesn't include the other issues that we've alluded to this morning in terms of when things go wrong and there's been some other activity that your office wants to protect the consumer. It wasn't an error and it wasn't an omission. It was fraud or whatever. This policy won't help you on the backside. The surety bond would.
Chair Przanski and Senator Linthicum, the surety bond never runs to us. We would never recover any amounts from a surety bond. Those are available for investors.
Well, by helping you, I meant help your office, help the consumer, i.e., help provide protection.
Yes, that's correct.
All right, I need clarification now, because what I've just heard seems like it runs contra to what my understanding. We're going to the insurance because we want to ensure that there's going to be money at the end of the day if and consumer is awarded some type of relief. Based on what I thought I've heard from the testimony, is two out of three are able to usually get relief, but a third or thereabouts, whatever that number is, isn't. And we think by going to this $1 million policy, that would in fact better protect and ensure as best you can that there'd be money to be paid out in an award that has been ordered. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, that's correct. Yes.
And Aaron, any other comments on that?
Senator Przanski, I think it's important that this is in addition to the existing bond.
Okay.
So one will cover fraud and and that sort of things. And then for the insurance, often, while it wouldn't cover fraud per se, it would cover failure to supervise or negligence and some sort of behavior down the line.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. That really does help. All right. We have go ahead.
Just a follow-up. So the errors and omissions covers items like negligence and
lack of supervision.
Lack of supervision.
Yeah. So, yeah, I could see where that could actually be played out, where someone who's actually managing the account is supposed to be overseen by one or two people above them, and things are just flying through, and they're either not checking it or they're signing off on something they shouldn't be. Is that a fair assessment? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Any other questions during our discussion? Not. We do have a motion before us to send Senate Bill 96A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any objection to the motion?
I'm just going to proceed with caution.
Okay.
Just, it sounds good, but I have some other questions.
I think my questions have been satisfied, but I, too, am hesitant. So,
all right,
proceed with caution.
All right. So do you want to be registered as a yes or no vote at this time, Senator Lithicum?
I'll register as a no.
Okay. Any other no's at this point? Not seeing. Motion passes. Senator Denborough, I'd ask you to be our carrier since you seem to pick up everything pretty quick here. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 96A. And that takes care of that. So we're going to go ahead and open up our last of our public hearings, which will be on Senate Bill 769. Chana?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 769 deals with documents and redacting things like Social Security numbers from those documents. The Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act prohibits a person from publicly posting or displaying a consumer's Social Security number unless it's redacted. In recent Oregon Court of Appeals decision, the court concluded that a company that put 30 boxes of mortgage documents containing Social Security numbers into a dumpster did not make them accessible to the public at large. Senate Bill 769 is an attempt to remedy that, and it says that a person may not dispose of documents that display a consumer's Social Security number unless it's been redacted or made unreadable prior to disposal. We've heard some concerns that this is a little too broad and unworkable and would have some unintended consequences, so we are working on amendments to this to narrow it down a little bit.
All right, so this is basically going to be for public hearing, and we'll see potentially some other work product coming out. Rick, you're here, and then I also see Dorothy Bean. Dorothy, why don't you come on up? And Rick, if you're going to take the lead, why don't you go ahead and start?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager for the Division of Financial Regulation. So thank you for considering Senate Bill 769, which was meant to be a fairly technical fix to a law that we thought was fairly settled since 2007 when the Act was enacted. While most of the Act deals with safeguarding electronic data and providing ways for customers or consumers to freeze their credit accounts, there was also some specific direction on Social Security numbers. At the time, I don't think you could have turned on the TV without seeing someone near a dumpster with reams of documents having very personal information on them. So since the 2007 Act was enacted, we've been taking various actions based on one provision of a law that says that a person may not publicly post or publicly display a consumer's Social Security number. Apologize for reading, but the idea was that the clause that we focused on said that publicly post or display meant to communicate or otherwise make available to the public. We've interpreted that provision to mean that if someone throws something away and it's available to the public, then that would have sufficed. We had at least 7 enforcement actions where we took some kind of administrative action, an order, civil penalty, that sort of thing, based on that theory. However, then in just this year, or 2016, the Court of Appeals handed down a decision where they said that the public post or publicly display was really about publication, like that you made it available to the public at large, posting it on a bulletin board as opposed to throwing it away. So our solution, which we intended to be fairly narrow and really only cover paper records, was to ensure that if someone was prior to disposal, was making it either unreadable or not able to put it back together, which is usually shredding or redaction. That was our intent. And so that's really what the bill is supposed to do. So with that, we can certainly take some questions. And I understand then we'll be working through some amendments to make sure that we have accurately captured that this is was supposed to be a narrow bill. So.
Okay, and I'll just give a little history here. 10 years ago when we put this together through a work group, I do see John Powell here. John and I suffered through those work group meetings where we brought a group of people, probably 40 to 50 individuals who came together, and we worked for 6 or 7 months and were able to actually get something out that everyone was happy with. I don't think it was ever our intent, even though we didn't use the appropriate language, to allow people to take sensitive credit information such as your Social Security ID and be able to throw it away. So it's unfortunate that we didn't use, clearer, cleaner language to ensure that not only posting in the sense, but also throwing it out would also be prohibited. So questions based on what we've heard so far? Senator Manning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this also apply? We're in an age of electronic use and communication and stuff. Would this also apply to electronic media as well?
Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, my sense is that that provision, 646A, 620, really focused on printing materials, printed documents. The rest of the statute really deals with the electronic data, how a company is supposed to maintain its appropriate safeguards and what to do in the event of a breach. 620, in my estimation, was really focused on these paper documents.
Okay, so any kind of way to get a hold of that the document? So, thank you.
Oh.
All
right. Any other questions?
Senator Manning brought up an interesting question with regard to the electronic form of that data, and I see this, and it reads okay. It sounds nice. I don't see any teeth in this. Wadding something up and throwing it away, versus shredding it, quote unquote, and the thoroughness of the shred job, If you put the piece of paper in wrong ways, your Social Security comes out on a strip vertical instead of a strip horizontal. There's just 1,000 variations. Any comments on that?
Chair Przanski and Senator Linthicum. So I would say in the outset that DCBS is really interested in making sure compliance with the law as opposed to gotcha moments. So in terms of that, I'm sure we could work with someone to make sure that they don't do something like that again. In terms of the enforcement authority that's available, there is a civil penalty authority in 646. And also as of the 15 session, DOJ is supposed to get notice of breaches that affect 250 or more folks. And then they've got remedies then that they can pursue based on that as well. So there is enforcement authority in the act. I could have Dorothy Bean speak a little more to that because Dorothy's actually conducted some of these. So.
And just quick follow-up, it's for large-scale violations, 250 or more type of scenarios where it's a large office.
Chair Przanski and Senator Linthicum, the notification to DOJ is 250 or over consumers affected by a potential breach. So
for it to kick into DOJ, there's a threshold 250. If it's not, then it's going to stay internal at this point, and it is set up on the electronic. If you haven't had a chance, you may want to read through the complete act as to everything that was covered. That was part of the stuff we did talk about was dealing with electronic. Rick, one thing I guess I wanted to follow up on is to how the it says just in the caption makes the Social Security number unreadable or prevents reconstruction. So just for the record, if someone is maintaining these records but they're not keeping on their public display the full Social Security number, just the last four, we would still assume that they're going to take some steps but probably need to take less steps just because the full number isn't posted or ID'd?
Chair Przanski, yes, that's correct. And I believe that you only have to redact so much of the Social Security number anyway under the existing law to begin with. So, yeah.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Thatcher.
I guess I wouldn't mind hearing what the issues were that make it appear that it's too broad, and maybe we don't need to have them sitting there for this explanation.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, there were two main issues that have been brought up, well, two to three. One is disposal. There's some of the agencies have had concerns that when they hand off documents to a person to be shredded, that the agency at that moment is disposing of it, has not been redacted at that point in time. So they don't want to get caught in this gray area where they've disposed of it, it's unredacted, but it will be redacted or shredded. The other is certain businesses regularly send documents at consumers' request that contain their full Social Security number. So tax preparers and attorneys who do bankruptcy, they don't want to get caught into this as well. So we're taking a look to make sure that when they send documents to consumers, they're not disposing of them. They're doing that. And there is a little concern with the electronic keeping of Social Security numbers in the last four digits. So we're looking into that as well.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right. And Dorothy, you're here. I know you're here as life support and lifeline and all that. Anything else that you'd like to add?
I don't have anything further to add, Senator Przanski.
All right. Thank you. So is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 769? Not seeing anybody. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 769, understanding that we're going to have a small work group that we'll be putting together, hopefully finishing touches for this can move forward. So with that, that concludes our work. We're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8. I did just want to let our two newer members know that we did have two bills today that had the A and gross versions. The reason for those coming to us is, one, they were in different committees, and we are pretty protective when it comes to stuff that we think should go to judiciary as well to ensure that we got all the T's crossed and all the I's dotted when it comes to the legal part. And so that is why we had subsequent referrals to the committee. So that will be something we'll see to some level, but this is kind of like a preview almost of something coming from the House, something that's been through someone else's eyes, and we're just giving another quick look. So with that, if there's not other comments or anything, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn us for today and see everyone tomorrow at 8. And see everyone tomorrow at 8.